Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the frightening fact that America's new national security advisor is a warmonger who will soon be the most influential person and the closest advisor to Donald Trump, who will sit at the apex of all national security information and other input coming into the White House that will shape U.S. policy and Trump's perception, which are already as belligerent as they are ignorant. David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, joins us to discuss the likelihood of a war with Iran and even the possibility of a nuclear war with North Korea. We will assess what the motives of Trump's biggest donors might be, since Netanyahu's patron and casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson brokered the deal that brought Bolton into the White House from Fox News, and how much Fox News and its owner Rupert Murdoch have essentially become the Dick Cheney of the Trump White House in what appears to be a co-presidency of Fox News and the right-wing echo chamber and Donald Trump. Then we will speak with Fernando Mosqueda, a youth leader at Community Coalition, a nonprofit that works to transform the social and economic conditions in South Los Angeles. He is a classmate and colleague of the 17-year-old Edna Chavez, who spoke so eloquently at yesterday's March for Our Lives demonstration in Washington, D.C., that close to a million attended. He joins us from Washington to talk about the inspiring event at which only high school students spoke, along with the survivors of the latest gun massacre that claimed 17 lives at the high school in Parkland, Florida. Then finally, Melody, Itayu, and Manny join us in the studio. They are dreamers based in Los Angeles and members of the California Dream Network, the youth branch of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. We will discuss Trump's effort to blame the Democrats for the situation that has 800,000 dreamers caught in limbo between being able to stay in the only country they know or be deported back to a foreign country. They will make it clear that it is Donald Trump who is holding the dreamers hostage to his demand to build a wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017. He is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you, David. And I would think the great question of tomorrow, now that John Bolton is about to be the National Security Council head and the most influential person in Washington, short of the president himself, in terms of national security and our very survival, is that, you know, tomorrow may involve a war with Iran or a nuclear war with North Korea.
Well, I think they are both options that Bolton has endorsed. He is a fan of preemptive strikes. He is a fan of regime change. He is one of the last remaining folks associated with the invasion of Iraq who thought it was a good idea. He's combative. He doesn't believe much in diplomacy. And he plays to the worst impulses of Donald Trump. And there are others now in high places or soon to be in high places in this administration who share the view. For example, incoming Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has also been one who has been a top hardliner, particularly with regard to Iran.
Well, Jonathan Stevenson, who was on the National Security Council, wrote in the New York Times, alluding to President Lincoln, he said, "This is not a team of rivals, but a gang of sycophants." And that's what I find particularly troubling. And one of the more frightening and ironic aspects of this is that what's happening in the White House is also mirrored in the Kremlin. Putin got rid of all of the sober people like Sergei Ivanov And he brought in these people like Nikolai Patrushev, who's his national security advisor. He's the guy behind this use of nerve gas in the UK, and a real hardliner and a hawk and an ignoramus to boot. So Putin is only has sycophants surrounding him and hawks and hardliners. And the same thing is happening now in the White House, where we have sycophants like Mike Pompeo and hawks and hardliners like John Bolton.
Right, and then that brings us to the guy who's in charge. You know, with Steve Hadley, who I respect a great deal, who was the national security advisor for President Bush, said, well, we don't have to worry about Pompeo's hawkish impulses because at the end of the day, the person who ultimately makes these decisions is Donald Trump. And I was, oddly enough, not comforted by that because impulsive, has no sense of consequences of actions, and is increasingly being cornered by legal troubles at home, which are going to give him every impulse both to try to distract from those troubles and to demonstrate that he's not wounded, that he's strong, that he's the tough guy that he thinks he is. And so you take this combination, Putin as you describe it, the global situation in Iran and North Korea, the legal situation of Trump at home, and that the new leadership of the U.S. National Security Team, which is by far the most hawkish and nationalist sort of anti-international institutions that we've had in recent memory. And that's a formula that's really quite worrisome. And we're going to get a dose of what it means really soon, because the president has been sending messages to friends and international colleagues alike that on or about May 12th, he's going to withdraw from the Iran nuclear accord. And if he does that, then we're going to be in a situation where we see what happens as tensions ramp up.
But I guess what's really scary here is that Donald Trump is a sociopath who only cares about himself. He has extreme narcissism and no empathy. So combined with having the nuclear codes or the ability to start a war in Iran or in North Korea, which would certainly likely to go nuclear, or at the very least, Seoul would be wiped out by conventional nuclear weapons. This is a man who cares, as you pointed out, his legal troubles and what's happened to him personally are more important than anything else. So if he's courted and if he's a trapped animal in the Oval Office, he's likely to lash out. Isn't that, you know, I don't mean to venture into cheap psychiatrics, but isn't that pretty clear?
I don't think it's cheap psychiatrics, and the people who dismiss, you know, trying to speculate about the psychology of the president, I think are people who don't recognize the precariousness of our position because of the psychology of the president. He has given every indication that is open to this even while he was getting good counsel. The sole remaining grown-up standing from that axis of adults that we once talked about is General Mattis, with McMaster and Tillerson gone and Kelly having disqualified himself. And General Mattis is reported to have said on Friday to members of his team that he didn't know that he'd be able to work very well with Bolton, who has a reputation for playing very nastily with folks in government, and whose views I suspect Mattis is going to find very discomforting. And so, you know, imagine a situation, heat's on Trump, Mattis may be on the outs, or his influence is certainly offset. And you know, quite apart from all of this, North Korea is dangerous. Kim Jong-un recognizes there's a benefit to him from to demonstrating his increasing capabilities. The Iranians are, trying to increase their influence throughout the Middle East. So what happens from all of these things? Well, one of the things that happens is that an outside impetus could also trigger conflict, just like the internal or the psychological could trigger conflict. Our trigger is now a hair trigger. And I think that ought to be a source of real discomfort for people.
And again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017. And he's the author of Running the World, Inside the National Security Council, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Well, but surely if this meeting, which is supposed to take place in Sweden or Finland or somewhere between Trump and Kim Jong-un, if it doesn't work out, and from what Bolton has said so far, he doesn't want it to work out. If it doesn't work out, which is highly, highly likely, and if it does work out, I think it'll be a bad deal in any case. It'll be more about Trump's vanity than about anything that's going to work. So let's assume that it doesn't work. Where does Kim Jong-un go from there? He can't go back to his own people. He's brainwashed and basically say, I tried and it didn't work out. He's going to have to turn up the heat, isn't he?
Well, I don't know that he's going to have to do anything, to be perfectly honest with you, because I think what's going to happen is that on or about May 12th, Trump's going to pull out of the Iran deal, and Kim Jong-un is going to be able to say, why would I negotiate a deal with somebody whose word is, you know, a country whose word is not good, that, you know, pulls out of agreements? And he's going to be able to walk away from it. I think the chances of a deal with North Korea are zero. I think they're zero because they haven't shown much interest in picking up on Trump's acceptance of the alleged invitation that existed. And there's some people who wonder whether it was really a full-fledged invitation. And so, you know, there's not much progress on the front. And I don't think that there's going to be a deal because I think of what's going to happen in Iran. But mostly I think it's not going to happen because it is not in the interest of Kim Jong-un to enter into a deal to give up his nuclear weapons. He's not going to give them up. And if denuclearization is the metric, then, you know, there is going to be no progress because there is no way he is going to denuclearize. And so I think that situation is going to be extremely hot. And I think with regard to the Iran situation, even though I don't think any other country is going to go along with the U.S. on this, and the other signatories to the agreement are going to get along with Iran, work with Iran, and offset the influence of the U.S., we have heightening tensions in that region because of, well, for example, Mohammed bin Salman, who's visiting the United States, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, has taken a much more belligerent tone. You know, I think that there is a really good possibility that tensions are going to grow in the Persian Gulf as well, which not going to be good for the price of oil, not going to be good for the global economy. And, oh, by the way, the United States is entering into a trade war with China, which could have the Chinese contemplating dumping U.S. dollars at certain points, since they're the largest holder of U.S. treasuries, which could have a negative economic effect as well. And so we're going to be in a dangerous world led by a group of people who don't believe in the fundamental tenets of 75 years of American policy, which is work through international institutions, approach conflict by seeking all measures short of war before going to war, use diplomacy, and work with allies. That's just not the approach of these folks.
And stand up for democracy.
Well, they don't even care. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just lip service. They don't care about democracy. I mean, well, but, you know, the most outstanding demonstration of democracy in the United States, you know, or in recent memory, might be, you might cite, you know, 800,000 young people in the streets of Washington calling for common sense gun reform. The president of the United States, who tweets about, you know, movie stars and reality shows and Fox News silliness, didn't even see fit to comment on it.
Well, he was busy playing golf in Florida.
I mean, well, I think they're keeping him on the golf course, because if he weren't on the golf course while he was listening to that, and his legal team was falling apart around his ears, and he's contemplating Stormy Daniels on the television, I think they want to keep him as far away from his phone to tweet and as far away from microphone as possible.
Well, you mentioned General Mattis being the last adult left, and even he's a hardliner, frankly. But compared to Bolton, he's a total peacenik. But this is what I find scary is that, you know, I get all these solicitations from right-wing think tanks and public relations groups and all these Koch brothers fronts offering up interviews in enormous number because they're very well-financed and well-organized. And I am beginning to see a kind of pattern here. It's almost as if Rupert Murdoch is the Dick Cheney of the Trump administration. There's a co-presidency going on here with Fox News and the right-wing echo chamber because they, for example, the drumbeat over the Nunes memo was going on and I got all the solicitations on that. And now I'm getting all the solicitations on firing Mueller. And that seems to be where this machinery is now focused. And it doesn't seem to be accidental. And when you've got so many people in Trump's White House now coming from Fox News, like Bolton, and remember that Sheldon Adelson was the person who brokered this deal. He was, along with Mercer, were the biggest donors to Trump. And there's no question Sheldon Adelson is close to Netanyahu. So, as you mentioned, he's going to tear up the Iran deal. That seems to be almost inevitable, isn't it, that they're going to do something about Iran? And, of course, as you pointed out, the price of oil would go up like crazy. And guess who would benefit from that? Vladimir Putin.
Well, candidly, so would the United States as a net exporter. So would the Persian Gulf states that have been, you know, also actively supporting this. You know, that's one of the reasons that for a long time I've felt that some kind of conflict with Iran was more likely. Because it's more in the interests of all the parties, and it's less likely to have a devastating consequence. The thing that should scare people more than that is North Korea, simply because there is no scenario for conflict on the Korean Peninsula that doesn't have tens or hundreds of thousands of casualties, because, as you noted, Seoul is within range of conventional artillery weapons from the north. And conventional rocketry from the north and so forth. And so, you know, these are all dangerous things. I have to say, you know, while these all, you know, are perfectly reasonable, factors as you determine whether or not you want to spend the next year or a couple of years hiding under your bed, I'm just as worried about what it does to the United States standing in the world, not only to appear irrational, not only to appear to be led by people who are contemptuous of the world, but to pull out of TPP, to pull out of the Paris Accords, to pull out of the Iran agreement, to renegotiate NAFTA, to undercut the United Nations, to undercut the World Trade Organization, to undercut the international systems that we've built, to gut the State Department, to eliminate diplomacy as an effective tool. It blows up a system we invested 75 years in building that is clearly in our interests because it preserves the peace and it promotes prosperity around the world and it shares the burden of dealing with a lot of these issues. And to me, you know, there is no snapback after that. You don't get rid of Trump and all of a sudden everything's fine. It's going to take a long time for the United States to restore its credibility and for those institutions to be restored to the kind of stature and standing that we need them to have.
Well, everything that Trump has done so far has helped Vladimir Putin, frankly. And apparently he got furious with McMaster because he said at the European Security Conference that there was incontrovertible evidence that Russia had meddled in our elections. And, of course, McMaster spoke with the previous National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, which is natural. You have to talk to your predecessors because national security issues don't suddenly stop when a new president comes in. And that apparently infuriated Trump. And just in the last minute then, you've got so much about Bolton, not just that he's a hawk and a warmonger, but he's a horrible person. As Carl Ford, the State Department official who testified against him during the Bush administration, he's a kiss-up, kick-down guy. He's been funded by the Mujahideen al-Haq, the really horrible Iranian opposition group. He endorsed a book by Pamela Geller, this disgraceful Islamophobic racist. and so on. So, as I say, it's not just that he's a danger to America and the world. He's also a horrible person. But I guess in the Trump administration, he'll fit in.
No question about that. And, you know, there are plenty to go with him. And, you know, I don't think we should turn away from the fact that typically we would look to the Congress for checks and balances that might offset some of the impulses of the administration. But we don't find those. They don't stand up to him. They don't seem to care that he's serving Vladimir Putin more actively and consistently than he's serving the American people. And this, you know, a lot of these people are living in a Fox News-generated bubble where it really is an alternative reality, where a lot of these things don't even show up on the news. You know, it's almost surreal. I have a hard time imagining how we've gotten to this point where the worst of us is leading and they're supported by a group of people who are being fed a vision of the world that is not actually the world, that is made up.
Well, that's why I think Fox Murdoch and the crow presidents, they're the Dick Cheneys of this administration. It's just shocking. And David Rothkopf, I really appreciate your time, and I'm grateful for you joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf. He's a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group, and is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with Fernando Mosqueda, a youth leader who, along with his classmate and colleague Edna Chavez, attended the March for Our Lives demonstration in Washington, D.C. yesterday.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Fernando Mosqueda, who's a youth leader at Community Coalition, a nonprofit that works to transform the social and economic conditions in South Los Angeles that foster addiction, crime, violence, and poverty by building a community institution that involves thousands in creating, influencing, and changing public policy. He joins us from Washington, D.C., where yesterday he participated in the March for Our Lives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fernando Mosqueda.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
So, Fernando, one of your colleagues from the Community Coalition in South Los Angeles, Edna Chavez, was one of the speakers yesterday. And I must say, she was very inspiring. And, of course, the one phrase of hers that's been picked up by the mainstream media was that she said, "I grew up learning how to duck bullets before I learned how to read." So do you feel like the message that she was bringing and that you were bringing to Washington, along with the students from Parkland High School in Florida, are reaching the American public?
Yes, I really think so. And I really hope that everyone's understanding, like, her true message around it. When we went back to the hotel, we were looking at the news articles and all the tweets that she was being put in, and to see that everyone's hearts and minds were being tapped into by her own personal story, to see that her narrative was was being broadcasted across different nations, not even just this nation. It really impacted all the youth that we have here in Washington D.C. because it shows, like, you know, even though we're in a small little neighborhood in South L.A., we still got an impact.
Well, I must say that I thought one of the most effective things, and of course I watched it on television, was that everybody on stage, with the exception of the performers, were high school students. Mm-hmm. And most of the people in the audience, you were there. Was the audience predominantly kids under 20?
In the stage, yeah, I was like, it was youth. It was like youth centered, and the speakers were, like you said, youth led, because this is a youth led movement. But the crowd was different. The crowd was intergenerational, interracial. It was an interracial crowd, and to see like that, it wasn't just like a youth problem. It truly is like a national problem. It's an issue that we need to talk about, and we need to talk about like the divisions that fall into gun violence, you know, the day-to-day actions, and then as well to mass shootings, you know. To see that everyone was just supporting it really shows, it was just amazing for me.
Well, I thought that what was really effective, particularly with your colleague Edna Chavez, was that it broadened it out, the issues out from just gun violence in the way that it impacted the high school in Florida and other schools like Sandy Hook and Columbine. But it also embraced the real issues that inner city kids suffer from, both in Chicago, which has a terribly high rate of gun violence, and South Los Angeles, which is what Edna was talking about. That was a real wake-up call, I think.
Yeah. When Edna really highlighted the importance of our mental health resources and after-school programs that are needed in communities like South L.A., Chicago, Baltimore, and New York, to show that, you know, mass shooting was a flashpoint, but we really need to discuss the day-to-day level of gun violence. We need to talk about the lives that are not in the headlines just because they're black and brown or come from poor communities. We need to talk about the things that we need and that legislators or representatives that need to represent us and our community need.
Well, she also made it real clear that having teachers armed and more security was a waste of time, money, and the wrong priority.
Yeah, we were discussing that before we came to Washington D.C. We were discussing about the language that came out of Columbine and how they implemented this policy of zero tolerance. And when we were talking about it, you know, we were like discussing like, oh, you know, most of the policies and that language was mainly implemented in the inner city schools. And we saw like a mass criminalization of black and brown students in South L.A. and other communities like that. Just because we're like, you know, we're low income, we have this there's like this preconceived notion about us. But when Edna like reversed that, saying that, you know, those policies don't work, and other students like her like recognize that those policies don't work. We need to get at the root issue, which is one, remove guns and restrict them, and two, make sure that we're talking about the mental aspect of this controversy.
Well, already the NRA, which was definitely the target of a lot of criticism coming from the students on stage, and I must say one of the more effective things that the refrain kept coming from many of the young speakers yesterday in Washington, D.C., they would turn behind them, you could see the Capitol Dome, and they would refer to corruption, and the NRA, and the word corruption and the NRA were almost intertwined. The NRA today, of course, came out and said that this was basically a sham paid for by some billionaires and Hollywood celebrities. But that's not the impression I had. This seemed to be an event of the high school kids, by the high school kids, and for the high school kids. So just let me know what your opinions are on the way it's been criticized, and tell us the real way that this was organized and how your colleague Edna came to be on stage and say what she said.
When we were approached by the organizers, they were talking to us about, like, you know, they chose us because of the work that we did, like, on the daily level, because we organize our high schools. We organize like on all the time, and we always talk about these discussions. And when we seen what happened in Parkland, we're like, they finally got their recognition, you know, and it was their first time organizing. But when we finally got that limelight, we were like, hey, you know, there's other high schools that are being talked to, and obviously there's gonna be criticism and like critiques about what she has said and what other students like her has said about the NRA or overall gun violence. And, you know, that's always expected, especially when it's like such a controversy and like when there's a sharp contrast between two different sides. But the like a lot of the arguments are coming from like the opposition. The arguments are based from a perspective from a nation that never had gun regulations. They don't understand that actual gun regulations can actually make a change. We see it in Japan. We see it in UK. They made changes, but you know the NRA and like other people that support the NRA. We just really hope that we get to like talk. Overall, we just really want to make sure that they're understanding our perspective, and if this we should see action, they should expect that, you know, we're coming full headstrong, how like more than just one nation, we're coming with like a people power. So yeah.
And again, I'm speaking with Fernando Mosqueda, a youth leader at Community Coalition, a nonprofit that works to transform the social and economic conditions in South Los Angeles that foster addiction, crime, violence, and poverty by building a community institution that involves thousands in creating, influencing, and changing public policy. He joins us from Washington, D.C., where yesterday he participated in the March for Our Lives. Well, of course, if you look at the record of who perpetrated these worst school massacres, Columbine, Sandy Hook, and the recent one in Florida, they're all disaffected white kids, along with this bomber down in Austin, Texas, who was motivated by some far-right Christian ideology, Christian hardly being the appropriate description. So why do you think our president, Donald Trump, spends so much time talking about a border wall, about MS-13, about how all the crime and violence and gun deaths are responsible, that how Latinos are in effect responsible, as opposed, and of course he always talks about Chicago, but never any mention of white terrorism.
I have to say one thing about Donald Trump. He's evil, but he's a cunning man. He understands that if he starts using this ideology and starts using this dialogue and you turning it against Latinos and people of color, you know what happens with Middle Easterns. You know that the whole language, it's to divide us. It's to like even push between Latinos and Blacks. There's some, what he's doing is making sure that it's this tactic of divide and conquer. It's divide and conquer. And so him and like a lot of other people, like they're. Like you said, you recognize the fact that a lot of them were just predominantly white students, you know, and like, yeah, that's a privilege because they're talked about and they're seeing like, there's just like you see headlines, the way that they take pictures or the way that they describe them. And, but when they're describing us, they see us as thugs or criminals or super predators. And so, you know, Donald Trump has made sure that a lot of the attention is to make sure that we're being criminalized and that we're being taken out of this country. Or we're put into to prison systems, but hopefully, when we talk about these issues, that people get to recognize the language that he's using, and that they get to recognize like the privilege that white people have, but also like that they need to like acknowledge that black people and brown people especially have been targeted, and that it's going to continuously happen, but they should work to dismantle that type of culture.
Well, I don't think that any of what Donald Trump is doing was working on the kids I saw yesterday in Washington, D.C., and you were there, Fernando Mosqueda. There seemed to be complete unity, post-racialism, if you will, and there was such solidarity and such a sense of community. And all of the things that Donald Trump stands for, which are the worst possible characteristics in humankind, hate, division, prejudice, greed, I saw the opposite yesterday in Washington, D.C., and in many cities across this country and around the world.
Mm-hmm. I feel exactly the same way. Because when Edna walked into the stage and when she spoke Spanish, my first initial reaction is how this crowd's going to respond. Are they going to start calling her an immigrant, an alien? Are they going to start saying stuff? But to see the crowd cheer when she said it in Spanish, to see her smile when they were recognizing her brother's name, when they were chanting it like it was no other name, like it had a message. It showed like Donald Trump tries to set walls, but we broke them and made bridges. That day was historical, as to see that everyone was down for the movement and everyone was down for their cause. and to see that it was especially youth-led, and that it was not only like supported by other youth, but other adults, and even the like old generation that like they're perceived to see a more conservative way, they were actually here for the movement, and to like that whole support, like definitely goes against what everyone has believed in the nation, that youth are like always they're naive and they don't know stuff, but we showed that wrong. Adults tend to be more conservative. They showed them otherwise. When I was looking at the crowd, everyone was just together. Everyone was always just supporting each other, and I love that.
Well, I must say that when Edna was talking about the death of her brother and how she watched him turn gray, that really struck me. It was just such a powerful image, and it's really the whole point, I think, of what the kids were saying yesterday was that, you know, it's almost like it's as simple as this, that the adults in this country have got to decide whether they're adults or parents. They've got to decide whether it's more important to protect their guns than to protect their own kids.
I remember I was in the crowd. I seen this one poster that rised up. It said, pop quiz. What do you choose, your kid or your gun? And exactly, that's the whole, like, even though that's their analysis, like, it's so powerful to see, like, everyone understands, like, you know, this is humanity we're talking about. These are human lives. And Edna Chavez was talking about her brother and how her brother was wiped off and all his dreams and all his aspirations were wiped off. And it was like, that wasn't the only person. You know, there's the Parkland students, there's the Sandra Hook, there's Columbine. And, like, these people, they had dreams. And to see it just go away in a bullet, it really hurt. But what was also so important to see is that power bloomed in their pain. And power was used that day.
And tell me about the political direction, because even though this was non-political or non-partisan, the message was real clear: vote, 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 and vote them out. Vote them out was a chant that I heard a lot throughout the event yesterday. I know there were voter registrations tables set up. What's your sense, yeah, Fernando, of how much the kids are going to show up in November?
They're going to show up and they're going to show out, especially with efforts like Why Vote. Community Coalition, when it was in October and November, we worked into pre-registering 16 and 17-year-olds and registering 18-year-olds in South LA, because we noticed that, like, you know, youth are, like, given this culture of, like, that there's no need for them to be civically engaged. But we shifted that. And, like I said, measures like from Why Vote, they're making sure that every youth are voting, and they're actually voting, like, for a great cause. And, you know, I actually truly believe that they're going to go out, because they understand, like, even though they can be out here marching, they can convince these people, institutions still have the power to, like, oppress people if they're not changing them within the system. So understanding that they're using the one of the greatest tools of democracy, voting, they're changing the system and they're changing public policies that write the margins of our lives.
Well, Fernando, I really appreciate you joining us and giving us a sense of what it was like yesterday. And could you pass on my congratulations to your colleague, Edna, because she was very inspiring, I must say.
All right. Thank you. Yes, I will tell her that. I think she's already basking in it. She's kind of shy, but she knows she's in the spotlight right now.
Well, she deserves it. And I thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Fernando Mosqueda, who's a youth leader at Community Coalition, a nonprofit that works to transform the social and economic conditions in South Los Angeles that foster addiction, crime, violence, and poverty by building a community institution that involves thousands in creating, influencing, and changing public policy. He joined us from Washington, D.C., where yesterday he participated in the March for Our Lives. We're going to take a brief station break and back, joined in the studio by three dreamers who Donald Trump is holding hostage to building his wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. But it won't be long, because kids with guns, easy does it, they've got something to say. Now they're turning into monsters.
such a winter's day. Stopped into a church, I passed along the way.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio are Melanie, Itayu, and Manny, who are dreamers based in Los Angeles and members of the Coalition Dream Network, the youth program of the Coalition of Humane Immigrant Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Manny, Itayu, and Melody. So, on Friday, Donald Trump tweeted out – actually, well, let's – before we get into that, because I think what we just heard was – and what I saw yesterday was really inspiring, and what we just heard from the guest that we just had on. What did you guys watch it, and what's your impressions? I'll start with you, Itayu.
It was a very touching speech for me because I also come from a – community that is also affected by this and by guns, and it has been a black and brown issue for quite a while now, and we have not been focusing on that issue, and it's very frustrating at the fact that they haven't been focusing on that issue, but now I've seen that there's been a lot of youth organizing and joining the movement from either from LA, South LA, or from those brown and black communities.
And Manny, what did you think of yesterday?
Right. So regarding the speech that Edna gave yesterday, it was very moving. It was very touching. She absolutely touched every single like string of, in my heart. It's a very touchy subject for some people. But seeing that the youth is going out there and mobilizing and making changes and it's amazing. It's motivational.
And Melody?
Yeah, we showed up to the Los Angeles March for Our Lives, so we were out there supporting. Obviously, maybe our lives haven't been directly impacted by this, but our communities are being directly affected by this. And for us to show up and say this has been an issue in our black communities, in our brown communities, we understand that in a way we wish that we could have gotten more attention already. In the last decades, but we are trying to also mobilize and have a platform from everyone to come out. So it was really, really interesting to come out yesterday in March and see a unity. But I really, and I speak with the other group as well, we really wish that this isn't just a one-day activism, that people continue to show up this year.
Well, they sure gave me the impression they weren't going away. So let's talk about, since you three of you are dreamers, Trump tweeted out on early on Friday that he considered vetoing the spending bill because there was no funding for his wall. And then later in the White House briefing, he said it was going to be a press conference, but it wasn't. He blamed the Democrats for not having the wall and that they don't care about dreamers. And of course, that's ridiculous. I'm not defending the Democrats. They've been kind of inept, but at least they've tried. And there is the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act, the DREAM Act, that they've been trying to put forward. They've made a couple of deals, they'll give Trump $25 billion for his ridiculous wall. But the bottom line for the Democrats is that it has to. The reciprocity, which a word that Trump uses, has to be a pathway for citizenship for 1.8 million immigrants. So that's where it is. It's obvious to me, I don't know how you guys feel, but it's obvious to me that one, Trump is not going, he doesn't want citizenship. He's the guy that rescinded DACA, at least Sessions did, but that's his guy, and that he's using his wall as a bargaining chip.
Yeah, we understand that this administration, by all means, is very strategic about everything that they put out, everything that they say. They're trying to make it seem like they do want to help us, but that the Democrats are holding them back from fully helping us. And we all understand that's a complete lie. This administration rescinded DACA for no reason. The end of DACA last September 5th, 2017, was a cruel action to take. There was no basis to it. DACA was unconstitutional, remains unconstitutional, and even though it's dead, our message has been very clear. And the replacement for us has been the Federal Dream Act. And I want to emphasize that the Federal Dream Act has been a fight since 2001. So it's almost been two decades since we've been fighting for our right to stay here and a pathway to citizenship, two things that DACA never had. So I know there's a lot of misinformation going around. DACA remains dead. And I know the San Francisco injunction that just happened and the Supreme Court decision that just happened has allowed us to continue renewing DACA permits, but there are no new applications. So high school students aging into the system will never know what DACA is. So we encourage folks to come out to CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. And we're between 3rd Street and Rampart and Carondelet Street. We're doing free renewal, so we're covering the $495 fee and any attorney fee. So we are waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on DACA by next spring, but we anticipate that this decision will not go our way, even though we have been very clear since September and before that, voicing our stories and telling everyone to have a heart.
And Manny, how does it feel to be a pawn in limbo, but between being deported to a country you don't know, mm-hmm. or being able to stay in the country that you grew up in?
Well, seeing that they're still pushing their nationalist agenda, which is clearly that's what's going on. Clearly the administration, the Trump administration, they do not care about us, the Dreamers. The only reason he's saying these things, such as trying to veto the spending bill, and it's just, again, push his agenda to fund the wall. He's this administration does not care about us. I can't stress that enough. The only reason he's we're students. You know, we're not, like you said, bargaining chips. We're not pawns. We're not numbers. We're kids. You know, we're just trying to hear to get a better education for ourselves, for our families, and for this country as well. And it's just ridiculous seeing that this administration is going back and forth. You know, one day they say we're going to help the Dreamers. One day they say we're going to kick them all out. And that's just unjust and it's unfair seeing that they're just going back and forth on this topic. And, you know, it's just and again, blaming the Democrats is something that's ridiculous, because obviously this was something done by the Republican Party and by Trump himself. So blaming and pointing fingers is something that he should not be doing.
And Itayu, mm-hmm. what's your sense of how racist this country is? Because clearly Trump is pandering to his base. He does that all the time. It's a strange situation to have a president who doesn't represent all Americans, which other previous presidents have done, even if they've come in on a whatever, if they're Democrats or if they're Republicans, they always tend, as presidents, to represent all of us because that's their job. This guy clearly doesn't try to represent anybody but people who watch Fox News. So what's your understanding of the base and why he continues to pander to them? And how big is this base, do you think? I mean, are we really all – is this the tyranny of the minority?
Well, in my opinion, I think America has always been racist, but now since Trump is president, everyone is already coming out. And as an undocumented person, I believe I was also invited by my representative Jimmy Gomez to go to the State of the Union, and seeing that entire room just full of, it was basically for me a KKK rally. It was a very horrible, but it also motivated me to push more in my community, because I have, as a year into activism, I can see that we still need a lot of movement with the youth, but also with adults. And a lot of undocumented people don't also view themselves as Dreamers. We're workers, we're your neighbors, we're teachers, we're students, or we're just a regular person. And I think that with this administration, we just have to all come together and fight it off.
Well, let me start with Melody and go to Manny and Itayu to have you briefly tell your story without giving too many details away, because I know you're in jeopardy because you're in limbo. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to get a sense of how you grew up and what's at stake for you and your family and your parents. I mean, you're either going to lose them or you're going to be deported yourselves.
Okay, we really don't like those statements because I think it just makes us, you know, people feel pity for us or I think they're more sensationalized. So we really just like to focus on the positive of our movement and what we have gained, especially here in California. So none of us are thinking about deportation. None of us are scared. None of us are in fear. And I can only speak for ourselves. I know that our community members are in fear, and that's why we're inviting them to get educated and learn about their rights, because even though you are undocumented, you do have constitutional rights. So none of that negative or what's going to happen with my family, that paralyzing fear is in us because we have gone through so much already and we have healed already and we have transformed all those negative emotions into positive actions to talk to others who are completely undocumented, who never even had DACA, to stand up for themselves in the 11 million who still don't have a status. So for me, my story, I was born in Guatemala. I was an orphan there, so I grew up without parents. It was a very rough childhood and full in poverty. And I came here when I was 9 years old to Los Angeles. So I grew up in Koreatown. I got my education. I was ready to go to college. I had a 3.9. I did ROTC. I took 6 APs. I was that poster dreamer that everyone talks about. And I want to emphasize that this is just one story. A lot of undocumented folks don't follow the educational path. They have their own story. So I'm only speaking on behalf of myself. Then I was ready to go to college and I figured out that I was undocumented. And I found out that I was going to have to work twice as hard to get half as far as everyone else. At the time, the California Dream Act, which allows undocumented students to get in-state financial aid, had not actually kicked off. So I had to work low-wage jobs to afford my education. It was a very horrible time. I went through a lot of mental health issues, coming to terms with what it meant to be undocumented. At the time, I didn't have DACA. I didn't get DACA till 2015. My life changed. I graduated from Cal State LA at the age of 20 with my bachelor's in communications and political science. And then I got involved with the California Dream Network, which is the youth program of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. And I was sold to the movement. I learned that I could stand up for myself, and more importantly, that I could deliver this information to others who were still in the shadows. So I decided to go on to get my master's at USC so that I could come back and help Chirla expand all their efforts. So I received my master's last May when I was 22, and I'm now an organizer with the organization. And it has been the privilege of my life to serve the immigrant rights movement and to meet people like Manny and Ita Yu and be there for themselves when they're liberating themselves. So that's just a little bit about myself.
And Manny?
So for myself, I came at the age of one. Ever since then, you know, it was a regular, like, you know, it's just a kid going to school here. He's unaware that obviously he wasn't born here. It's just a kid. You know, I grew up, I went to high school. And once high school came, fortunately, again, this is my story. So unfortunately for other dreamers at that age, some of them were already going to college. I was in high school and President Obama actually declared the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. So I didn't go through the struggle of graduating high school and of trying to look for a job that would eventually just help me pay some part of my tuition. So I thank God that I had that gift in a way to find a job that would pay me what I was supposed to be paid, and to have AB 540. You know, being in California, it's a progressive state. We have AB 540, Cal Grants A and B. We have AB 130, 131, which help undocumented students to progress into higher education. So having these resources obtainable to me, a DACA recipient, and you know, undocumented as well in this country, you know, it benefited me. And my experience was, again, my experience was a bit more like high school student post DACA in a way, not pre DACA. So I did not have that, like, that rough childhood experience that, you know, other dreamers tell. I'm currently in college. I go to Santa Monica City. I'm 20 years old again, and my major is the general science to take into biology.
Is that you?
Yes, I came to the U.S. at 6 months from Mexico. I have lived my entire life in Los Angeles. At age 14, I found out I was undocumented. I also come from a mixed status family, so where my sister's a U.S. citizen and I'm undocumented. And I went, I got DACA when I was in high school, so it was 2015. But also remember that DACA wasn't out of Obama's heart. It was because of the people who went out and fought for DACA. I just wanted to clear that up. I also, thankfully, I have really supporting parents. So with my sister being a U.S. citizen, I always saw her travel around the world, doing abroad and going to a out-of-state college. So I got the opportunity to go to a college in Maryland studying political science and international business. And now I have joined the California Dream Network about a year ago, and I have been fighting for our rights and also for the 11 million undocumented people.
Well, just in the last minute, each of you with a minute. And by the way, I don't think that we're feeling sorry for you. We're very impressed by you. I am, and I'm sure our audience is. Given that you are inspiring us and informing us about the reality of your lives and what needs to be done, what do you want seen done?
Yeah, we have been very clear about this since September 5th. We want a clean Dream Act. The Dream Act is better than DACA because it is a permanent solution. It has bicameral support, and it has a pathway to citizenship. So all of us can be citizens in about 15 years. So it is not a short pathway to citizenship. And that's a whole other conversation we can have. But again, the Dream Act for us is the answer. Obviously, we want a comprehensive immigration reform, but we're talking about what's on the table. So we were not included in this last budget or in this omnibus that was just approved. So we want people to still come out and help us. We have a shot this June with a Queen of the Hill approach introduced by Representative Jeff Denham. There are so many issues that are out there of communities that are being attacked by this administration. Muslim refugees, LGBT, TPS. So this is just one piece of the cake that we're asking folks to come and support us for a Clean Dream Act.
Manny, a quick minute.
Okay. Again, same thing as Melody. It's a Clean Dream Act. That's what we're fighting for. Again, we don't want a quote unquote a dirty Dream Act because what I mean by that is that it's going to we don't want them to categorize us as second class citizens. We want to eventually legalize our parents that they came to this country. Obviously, to fight for a better life. We want something that's going to provide us a pathway to citizenship and something that will eventually give us turn our dreams into a reality.
And Natalia, what do you want?
The same as both of Manny and Melody, a Clean Dream Act. But we also need the community to come out and do civic engagement. It is re-election, and we need them to vote, go out and vote and mobilize their community, because we still have 3 years of this administration, and that's how we are all going to get through this together.
Well, I thank all of you for joining us here in the studio, our three dreamers, Melody Atayu and Manny. They're based in Los Angeles, members of the California Dream Network, the youth program of the Coalition of Humane Immigrants' Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.